from the Sky News Centre at 5. The Prime Minister's just arrived at the White House for a meeting with Donald Trump. She's the first foreign leader to hold face-to-face talks with the new US president since he came to power. The pair are expected to discuss security and a free trade deal between the two countries when the UK leaves the EU. Sir Peter Westmacott, the UK's former ambassador to America, says that's important.
That chimes with Donald Trump's approach. He doesn't like multilateral trade deals, doesn't think they work. They're really hard to negotiate, as we know. So I think for the UK to get a strong message, a green light from Donald Trump, will be important.
The Lib Dem leaders describe comments from the man in charge of UKIP on torture as shocking and disappointing. Paul Nuttall said waterboarding during the interrogation of terror suspects was a price worth paying if it saves lives. A haulage company owner and a mechanic have been jailed for a total of nearly 13 years over a tipper truck crash that killed four people in Bath. They were convicted of manslaughter after the vehicle's brakes failed on a steep road in 2015. Gary Ray from the road safety charity Brake thinks men should have been given longer sentences.
These were manslaughter charges, and of course manslaughter carries a life sentence in certain cases. We didn't get into double figures here. Let's remember four people lost their lives here.
Joe Stevens is quitting Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet in protest at the Labour leader's stance on leaving the EU. He told MPs they should vote in favour of a bill that allows Theresa May to trigger the exit process. Rafael Nadal will take on Roger Federer in Sunday's Australian Open tennis final, the first time they've fought it out for a Grand Slam title in nearly 6 years. Nadal beat Grigor Dimitrov in five sets in the last four. And Ant and Dec have received their OBEs at Buckingham Palace.
It's still kind of sinking in, really. It's a bit mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a surreal way to end the week.
Prince Charles presented the honours earlier for their services to entertainment. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Annie Green.
Live from inner city Bristol.
Keeping Bristol together.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock again, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Eastville, Vari Threlfall. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a decade of Republican policy changes are signed off in 1 week as the searchlights on Trump card Don's high tower swivel away from Russia and turn to point at China. Hillary Clinton seems to have managed to escape criticism as the ruthless Lady Macbeth of the piece, her crooked superdelegates having stolen the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders, helped Donald Trump to win. Also, the Zionist lobby is preparing to celebrate, poised to tick off point four, nearly two-thirds of the way along their six-point plan for white Europeans to take over the Middle East. I'm talking about the moving of the Israeli capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That's step four of six, towards potentially, at the end of it all, a religious war. We took another look tonight at the evidence for this long-term crusader land grab nearly 1,000 years after the medieval First Crusade, and every bit as barbaric. Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu's 1980 book Terrorism, How the West Can Win, and the infamous Oded Yinon plan to balkanise the Middle East. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and heavy rain. This weekend, highs around 10, sunny spells tomorrow and showers on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11, plenty of showers all week, pretty much. And next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of February, highs around 11 and another wet weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Eastville, Vari Threlfall. Hi, Vari. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
You tell us a bit about your background. What got you into the politics and the Labour Party particularly?
So I've been a Labour councillor since 2013. I originally joined the Labour Party shortly after the general election in 2010. I am myself a bit of a Labour baby. I was brought up under Labour administration. So the threat at the time of a coalition government, I mean, if you think of the situation back in 2010-11, it almost seems like a distant memory now that we've had Brexit, we've had the general election in 2015, and of course now Donald Trump in the White House. So my motivation really at the time was around issues in my ward. My ward is Eastville, covers sort of Fish Ponds area, Lower Eastville, Stapleton and Whitehall. And there was a huge number of issues ranging from prostitution and waste issues. It's huge issues around fly tipping and also issues around sort of community cohesion. So there was a lot of motivations there in terms of actually seeing politics as possibly a way of being able to change some of those issues and situations in the ward.
Are you a Corbynista?
Yeah, so I did vote for Jeremy Corbyn twice, which seems ridiculous to say, but yeah, so I was supportive of Jeremy Corbyn.
And what about a Brexiteer?
No, absolutely not. So a huge percentage in Bristol obviously was campaigning and supported to stay in the European Union.
So if you were an MP now, what would you say if Jeremy Corbyn said to you, you've got to vote for Brexit next week?
I think it's a really sort of conflicted thing. I think really, to be honest, MPs should be responding to how their constituents had voted within the referendum. I mean, from my personal opinion, I want to fight for the European Union. I want to fight for free movement. I think it's a shame that that's kind of come out from the National Party. And I do respect MPs that are pushing back on that and saying that they want to represent the views of their constituents.
Now, one of the things I'd just point out with this whole free movement is that it's almost as if we've kind of gone into this thing, the common market, and with the Lisbon Treaty and all this stuff, which is to do with free movement of goods, right? Free trade. And it's then become like free movement of people too. It's almost as if people are being seen just like goods. Now they can just move around. If goods can move around, so can people.
Absolutely, and I think there's a real concern there then of dehumanising a lot of certainly the catastrophes and issues that we've seen. I mean, Syria is a great example where the press particularly have dehumanised that movement of people, and it's resulted, I think, a lot in actually the rise of fascism throughout Europe. And actually you've seen, I think, with the recent vote in the referendum, actually how that dehumanisation of the free movement of people has impacted on a lot of the way that people view.
But I mean, I'm talking also from a perspective of a big corporation. They obviously want to outsource stuff, bring stuff in free from somewhere where maybe there's sweatshops or, you know, there's not very good conditions like there may be here in Britain. I mean, actually, some of the conditions here in Britain are pretty awful. But we've moved into this world almost without thinking about it, where goods are just treated, or people are treated like goods. It just sounds strange.
I wouldn't say entirely that people haven't really thought it through. I mean, Europe has given a lot in terms of workers' rights, environmental conditions, all those sorts of things. So there are certain things that I think a lot of people are concerned that with Brexit might not necessarily stay in place subsequently. So,
okay, before we hear from Martin on this, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, because this whole issue of workers' rights came up at PMQs with Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn pointing out some of the problems with it, with the potential anyway. In fact, it's actually happening, assault on workers' rights that's coming with, and some of the protections that Europe has been giving may be disappearing.
The evidence of what the Tory party and this government really thinks about workers' rights was there for all to see yesterday. A private member's bill under the 10-minute rule bill by a Tory MP to tear up parts of the International Labour Organization Convention, talking down my friend the member for Grimsby's bill to protect European workers' rights that have been obtained in this country. That is the real agenda of the Tory party. Mr. Speaker, what the Prime Minister is doing is petulantly aiming a threat at our public services with her threats about a bargain basement Britain. Is her priority our struggling NHS, those denied social care, children having their school funding cut, or is it once again further cuts in big business taxation to make the rich even better off?
Prime Minister!
I would simply remind the Right Honourable Gentleman on the issue of workers' rights that I have been very clear that this government will protect workers' rights. Indeed, we have a review of modern employment law to ensure that employment legislation is keeping up with the modern labour market. One of the objectives I set out in my plan for our negotiating objectives was to protect workers' rights. But he talks about threats to public services. I'll tell him what the threat to public services would be. It would be a Labour government borrowing £500 million extra pounds. That would destroy our economy and mean no funding for our public services.
Well, and this idea that borrowing money is a threat to public services is just counterintuitive, isn't it? I mean, in actual fact, with interest rates at zero,
it's not.
Virtually,
I mean, if government is increasing the borrowing and increasing the deficit, surely that's not going to be good for the country as a whole.
No, but that presumes an awful lot of economic argument, which she didn't make. In actual fact, when interest rates are nearly zero, it's actually cheap for the government to borrow to invest in infrastructure. And that's precisely what they should be. That's what Donald Trump claims he's going to do in the US, unless Janet Yellen raises the interest rate, of course, or the markets decide that Trump's a loser and crush the economy.
But actually, we've kind of deviated from the question there. Yeah. This is actually about workers' rights, isn't it? And I noticed, didn't get much coverage in the national press, but it was certainly big headlines in the Grimsby Telegraph. A bid to protect workers' rights was blocked due to a Tory MP filibustering on the love of radio for 4 hours. Now, that sounds like an abuse of our wonderful profession here. A new law designed by Grimsby MP to protect workers' rights after Brexit was blocked from being debated in Parliament due to Tory MPs choosing to talk about their love of radio for 4 hours. Melanie Ons' proposed bill, that's O-N-N, proposed bill, was third on the list to be heard on Friday, but backbench MPs stretched out the debate on widening the scope of digital radio services, boo, hiss, don't like digital radio, from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. under orders from their bosses at the Whip's office.
So in other words, it wasn't just somebody doing this off their own bat, the Tory Whips coordinated it to prevent a private member's bill to protect workers' rights. Well, as Jeremy Corbyn was right to pick up on that then, wasn't he?
Yes, absolutely. No, I agree. And I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, this was an example of one of many examples of the Tory government doing this. And when Theresa May talks about workers' rights, you have to really question what she's actually talking about. You hear this word gig economy quite a lot, and she talks about, you know, free movement in terms of workplace. And I think actually it's consistent, their approach to dissolving anything to do with actually the workers having any rights at all.
Well, that's actually what Melanie Onn was saying this week, was that her bill would go no further, I quote her here, than what Theresa May and David Davis promised last year to ensure that the rights currently offered to British workers are maintained after Brexit. So that's what she said. It does seem like this Brexit could be an excuse to go really have a massive shift to the right here in Britain.
Absolutely, but there's still scope though, and there's still hope. Certainly the SNP are looking at putting 50 plus amendments. Labour have got 7 amendments towards this Article 50 discussion that's happening next week on Tuesday, and certainly one of our main amendments to this would be around ensuring that we protect workers' rights in the case of Brexit.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I think that the fact is that they're actually trying to derogate from international labour organisation rights, which aren't even to do with the European Union. They're international standards, which they want to wriggle out of. Mm. Why would they want to wriggle out of the bottom line international standards, which don't just cover Europe, they cover the whole world? and that pretty much says where they want to go, doesn't it?
Well, I'm afraid Brexit is another question from Prime Minister's Questions Now about that. This one's from Chris Bryant over in the Rhondda, and he's wondering if the big landowners, the big dukes who've owned this land for like 700-800 years are still going to get their, most of them get around about between half a million and £1 million a year subsidy from the Common Agricultural Policy, which seems bizarre since they're the richest people in the world. They're getting this amazing benefits. Well, the next story we'll come to will show you how some people have been cut off from their benefits. But let's hear from Chris Bryant now.
Chris Bryant.
When she introduces a UK agricultural policy, because we're out of the Common Agricultural Policy, will the Duke of Westminster still receive £407,000 a year? Will the Duke of Northumberland still receive £475,000 a year? And will the Earl of Ivor still receive £915,000 a year from the British taxpayer?
Well, gentlemen, it seems to know a lot about these ducal matters. Most interesting. I'm fascinated by the reply. Let's hear it. Prime Minister.
When we, one of the tasks that we do will have, and the Honourable Gentleman is right, when we leave the European Union, is to decide what support is provided to agriculture as a result of being outside the Common Agricultural Policy. I can assure him that we are taking the interests of all parts of the United Kingdom into account when we look at that system and what it should be in the future.
Yeah. Martin, what do you make of that? I don't know who this Earl of Ivor is. He's getting almost £1 million a year subsidy by the Common Agricultural Policy. He's a massive landowner.
Well, a few years ago now, it must be nearly 15 years ago now, Ray McSharry, who is the Irish agricultural, he was a European Commissioner for Agriculture, and he put forward what we call the McSharry Principles. And what we the Common Agricultural Policy is it basically subsidises production. And he was saying, well, actually, the purpose of the Common Agricultural Policy is to protect small farmers in marginal areas, like North Wales, for example. Now, if you want to protect small farmers in North Wales, a production subsidy is not the way to go. And that's why the Welsh Farmers Union split from the National Farmers Union, which is only based in England, in the 1950s. Because the interests of big farmers in England are completely different from the interests of small farmers in North Wales. Now, what McSharry was proposing, based on what went on in the west of Ireland, is if we're going to subsidise, we should subsidise per working farmer. Per working farmer, and we won't subsidise production. And that virtually everybody in Europe had agreed that we were going to move away from production subsidies. Do you know who wrecked that? The British. Because they wanted to carry on having big subsidies. They said it's unfair to our farmers, who are bigger than everybody else's farmers, if we move towards subsidising small farmers. So they scuppered it, and the McSharry principles were knackered. And in actual fact, of course, if Britain hadn't been in the EU, the EU could have reformed their common agricultural policy in that direction. But we sabotaged that. And in order to keep the money flowing to the Duke of Westminster. And I think that those Tories who've supported Brexit, like the Duke of Westminster and many others, have got to realise that people living in urban areas like us are not going to be as generous as Brussels when it comes to handing out the sweeties.
Well, I'll give you a clue about the Earl of Ivor, just looking him up. His name is Edward Guinness, the fourth Earl of Ivor. He was one of the people behind Ernest Saunders and the Guinness scandal. But this does sound a bit cheeky, doesn't it, for some of the richest people to be, and actually what Theresa May is doing there is she's hinting that these massive subsidies, basically this is like getting your benefits but not even having to bother to sign on, and not only getting whatever it is about £3,000 or £4,000 a year, getting £1 million a year.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all really very much about entitlement, isn't it? And what's quite interesting about the Common Agricultural Policy is, so in Bristol, we're very much a food city. We've got a lot of small food production facilities, so small farms, etc. None of those individuals, because of the size of their land, have actually benefited from any of this funding or support. And I think absolutely there needs to be reform if this is going to go forward. We cannot be working within this old system where these rich landowners are getting huge subsidies.
Yeah, the obvious thing seems to be to subsidise farmers up to a certain size of farm, and once they've got maybe over 100 acres or something. I mean, it seems strange that these people are subsidised for land that they probably never even walked within miles of it, you know.
I don't suppose they're mucking out the pigsties, are they, these guys?
They certainly not. No. Anyway, look, let's just go back to look at some local stuff for a minute. And Vari, you know, I know you've had this ongoing sort of, I suppose you could call it a running sore, but some are actually looking forward to getting a Big Mac in Eastfield. aren't they?
Absolutely not. So this has been going on. It's an 18-month battle, essentially, against what would be considered to be the largest drive-through McDonald's in the southwest. They're looking at locating it in a residential area off Fishponds Road, which is also a hugely congested road as is. And the predicted number of vehicles for this drive-through would be about 129 additional vehicles on the road per hour. So as you can imagine, local people are not very happy about it. It's situated
between...
How do
they know that, 129 vehicles an hour?
So they've done traffic surveys. So this is actually quoted from McDonald's own traffic survey. It's located
very precise,
actually.
Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's we actually believe it's possibly more from the residents have actually gathered together. They formed a group called Nota McDonald's, and they've done their own traffic surveys. But additionally, this McDonald's location is actually located between three different schools. And I think there's a lot of concern locally around the public health agenda. And actually, again, McDonald's in their own documents have quoted issues around the number of takeaways and the direct link to obesity.
But some of your constituents probably will be wanting... They're at McDonald's there, weren't they?
So there's one up the road to Abbeywood. they're welcome to go along to. And we've also got a huge concentration of takeaways. We had over 500 objections to the planning application, which was well over, I think, 12 months ago now. It was 18 months ago. And the council rejected it on sound planning grounds. McDonald's are now taking the council to appeal. This is going to the planning inspectorate and could cost the city council, if lost, almost £1 million in lost revenue to McDonald's Global.
But won't the city council actually make money from this once the business rates, once the place is built?
No. So the reason this planning application was rejected was based on the fact that actually it would have a lot more serious impact on the sort of traffic and public health concerns. So if you looked at it in isolation, you went, okay, how many business rates, can we collect? What's the valuation? Yes, okay, you could look at it from that perspective. But if you look at it from a more holistic perspective on the impact on public health, the impact on traffic, the impact on air pollution, and all the other material considerations that this planning application was rejected on, it actually has a negative impact on the local area.
Just remind me exactly again whereabouts it's planning to do it.
So it's the old tile place on Fishponds Road is where the application was for.
Okay. Also, you've got, I mean, you mentioned it briefly, didn't you, a bit earlier, which is problems with waste, people's rubbish not really being, or having bit sort of lying around the streets, and also fly tipping. I mean, this is particularly bad in around Eastville.
Yeah, and particularly I think the location where we have huge concentrations of fly tipping, it's just off the M32. So a lot of the fly tipping actually comes from outside the area. It's driven down, is dumped, and we've had a huge issue over the past 5 years tackling this issue. Fortunately, last year we awarded a contract, Bristol City Council, to Bristol Waste, which is a municipal waste company. And what is really fantastic is actually how local people have come together, formed a sort of working group, and are now working with Bristol Waste on tackling this issue.
But what about charging for people? I mean, if sometimes you've got stuff that you need to get rid of, you manage to persuade a friend to borrow a car, maybe an estate car, stick the stuff in the back, and then sometimes you're still going to have to pay to actually take that. I mean, fly tipping's bound to happen if people don't have a lot of money, but they've got waste, maybe an old sofa or something they need to get rid of.
So one of the key things that we've been looking at is the policy around home waste recycling centres, but also looking at reuse as well. One of the key things is a lot of people aren't aware of are the Bristol reuse charities that will take your sofa, will repurpose it, and it'll have perhaps a different home.
I suppose,
or it'll be
all
reused.
I'm saying is if you're going to try and charge poor people for getting rid of rubbish, there's going to be fly tipping. End of the story. It needs to be free. There needs to be somewhere that they can take it where they're not having to pay to do it. Otherwise, they'll just dump it. I mean, that seems a bit of a no brainer. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of the sort of lack of? I mean, there's been a slow wind down in the amount of rubbish collection. Isn't there now? It's down to once a fortnight or so.
Well, it's all part of cuts, isn't it?
I mean, you know, if you're going to cut local authority budgets, then that's the sort of thing that's going to take the heat, isn't it?
We were hearing from Mark Bradshaw last week that it looks like by 2020 there may be no money at all coming from central government, and you're going to have to raise it all from council tax. How are you going to manage?
It's going to be incredibly difficult, and I think this seems to be a sort of Tory government agenda. I mean, absolutely, austerity is about cutting local authorities, cutting their power to actually help in many different ways. And I think we're really going to have to think about how the local authority looks in the case of the next
few years.
Well,
it's going to be hardly anything left, is
there? Well, we've got council tax, business rates, and the local government, the national government is assuming that's what the councils are going to be able to rely on. I mean, the maths just doesn't add up.
It doesn't, does it? It's going to be pretty horrific by then. Nothing much in the way of services left. I think, you know, people are rightly thinking, well, why are we paying council tax? This is a regressive tax. It falls much more on poorer people for a service which is going down and down all the time. And some of the services are going to go completely.
Absolutely. I think I agree entirely. I mean, council tax is a regressive tax. I mean, we are one of the only local authorities that have managed to protect our council tax reduction scheme. So the most vulnerable in the city don't actually have to pay council tax. So we're quite proud of that. And we've managed to maintain that in face of the cuts. And under Marvin Rees' leadership, he's very much looking at this, actually. How do we manage to look at maybe creative ways of income generation so that we can actually start pushing back a little bit and resisting some of these, the most harsh cuts.
Well, the cuts aren't just falling locally, folks, as I'm sure you know, national too, and particularly with these organisations like the Department for Work and Pensions are cutting and cutting and cutting, and this is meaning that many people out there who are either on permanent sick, in other words, doctors have signed them off as unable to work or disabled in one way or another, are just simply finding that arbitrary reasons are being found to stop their benefits. And earlier this week, and it's going to be on next week's Dialect, the full interview, I spoke to Chris Jones, who lives in Nelson, which is near Merthyr Tydfil. And he explained to me just what his situation is, and he hasn't had any money since November. He is actually very sick. He's got sciatica, and all the jobs that he's had recently, within 2 days he's been sacked because he simply can't do any kind of heavy work. And his doctor has signed him off, said, look, this guy's really sick, he can't work, and yet the benefits people, the DWP, rather facelessly have just said, no, we don't agree with your doctor, and they've cut his benefits. So let's have a quick listen to Chris's story now.
I've got serious mobility issues because of my lower back problems. I've got an ALS for my emphysema. I've got pain throughout my body because of my arthritis. And I've got appointments to see all these specialists, yet they ignore it all. So there should be someone we can go to say, look, this is affecting my life. It needs sorting out today or tomorrow, not in 8 weeks or 16 months' time.
Now, I mean, it just sounds almost as if there's a kind of viciousness and cruelty to the way you're being treated. How do you cope with that?
I don't, to be honest with you. I lock myself away and I hibernate. And my son goes up to his mother as if I got him here, and if he stays with me, the plan was when I won custody of him, we'd have him half a week, as long as she lived by the rules, and she did, and she's brilliant, so she has him half a week, but whenever he's up there over the weekends, all I do is lie in bed with a quilt over my head. Because I'm scared to go out and go to the shop and that, because even if I go to the shop and someone looks at me going, oh, I feel everyone's judging me all the time.
I mean, it just sounds very strange when a doctor is saying one thing and the people are just trying to cut you off from benefits. What do you think they're actually trying to do?
I actually think they're trying to kill me through stress and anxiety. Because I don't know why, but I feel that they believe what the government's telling them, and they think that it's people like us who want benefits that are draining the state. But it's not, it's the government trying to chuck us off because it costs them 10 times more money than we'll ever have in a lifetime of one benefit for them to chuck us off, because I'm sure they've wasted over £1 million of the taxpayers' money trying to get me off a benefit where I get about 100 grand in a lifetime.
So you can hear that full interview on Tuesday at noon on our Dialect show. But Martin, Chris there hasn't had any money since November.
Well, it strikes me as absolutely unacceptable that anybody other than a qualified doctor should be making decisions about who is and who is not fit for work. How can a bureaucrat a low-level bureaucrat at the Department of Work and Pensions, or ATOS, or whoever's doing this, overrule the decision of a medical doctor. That is absolutely unacceptable. But nevertheless, it's become the norm. And the film I, Daniel Blake, made by Ken Loach, is about exactly a similar case. It's obviously a fictional case, but it's based on real facts like this one.
Vari, I mean, he's in a situation where he's actually feeling like it's his fault somehow. He feels afraid to go out. He thinks people will judge him. And it seems almost like, you know, psychologically, he's not necessarily going to be able to deal with this. Anyway, we'll be following this over previous weeks, but it seems amazing that someone who's been cut off from benefits, even though they're entitled to them, they feel like it's their fault.
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely agree that it's absolutely unacceptable. And unfortunately, this isn't an isolated case. I mean, I hear regularly, I mean, about twice a week, I get similar cases, whether it is linked to housing or whether it's linked to disability benefits, so the DWP. So it just... it's incredibly, incredibly depressing that anybody could get to that point where suddenly something that isn't their fault, that they have no control of, whether it's an illness or whatever else, they've lost their home through no fault of their own, that suddenly that comes back to them and they're being told it's their fault. And it seems to be a pattern with this Tory government to do that, to say, actually, it's not us, we're not doing anything wrong, it's the doctors who are messing up in these hospitals. It's not because of cuts and pressure. It's the housing officers, because they're not being able to deal with this, and it's the individuals themselves that are at fault, which is, it's absolutely disgusting.
Well, you hear these sorts of cases, are you able to actually help anyone?
It's incredibly challenging. I mean, I'm quite fortunate in my ward. Kerry McCarthy, the local MP, is very involved locally, and so therefore, if there are national cases, we work together in partnership. Locally, in terms of housing issues, we've got a very stretched but very active housing team, and it's about trying to work with them to try and mitigate as much as possible. But without resource, without funding, it's getting to a worse and worse situation.
I suppose what I'm saying is, can you put pressure on, maybe with a bit of help from Kerry, to actually get these benefits paid? I mean, this guy clearly has got... I mean, he actually sent me, emailed me, all of the letters from his doctor, which prove what he's saying is true. And yet they're still saying, no, you can't have any money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean... he's in South Wales, isn't he, at the moment? So what I would do is I would urge anybody in a similar situation to go to their local councillor, to go to their local MP, and get them to champion them on their behalf.
Martin, what about this whole psychological side about making people feel it's their fault?
Well, the politics behind this are, because of the way the electoral system works, you've got several hundred thousand people in swing constituencies, mostly in the satellite towns around London, that decide UK general elections. And the focus groups, which all the political parties run, show that within the 100,000 people that decide elections, several hundred thousand, they buy into this idea that there's too many people on benefits, they're all work shy, this, that and the other. Now, if you want to win a general election, you've got to keep these people happy, which is why many Labour MPs abstained on the welfare bill that the Tories brought forward, because they know that they don't want to be seen to be the friend of the people in South Wales. See, people in South Wales are going to vote Labour, whatever, and therefore their votes don't count. It's irrelevant what they think. And of course, what happened in South Wales in the 1980s is that the strategy of the Tory government of that era was to get the unemployment figures down by getting people signed off as sick. And at that stage, that was an acceptable thing. In places like Merthyr and so on, people were signed off sick as a way of not being registered as unemployed, because there's no work for them. There was no work for them in the 80s. There's still no work for them now. Probably there's never going to be any work for them in Merthyr, which is why we might have to talk about things like a citizen's income and so on. But of course, the nastiness of all of this is calculated. It's about trying to make the relatively comfortable blame the people at the bottom of the pile instead of the bankers and all the people at the top of the pile who are really responsible. And it works.
That's scary, isn't it? Anyway, we'll be following Chris Jones's case, just let you know over the next few weeks and months how he gets on. The other thing, of course, is don't just get hold of Vari and Kerry McCarthy or whoever it is, your councillors, your MPs. Get hold of pick up the phone to the BBC and the Press and the Post, and if they don't answer you, pick up the phone to us and we will tell your story, because it's important that these people are heard. It's absolutely no way that we want people to be suffering in silence, and I'm so glad that Chris got in touch with me on Twitter actually, to help me to tell his story. Also, another massive problem is funding for social care, which nothing has been done about. That came up at Prime Minister's Questions 2 this week.
Maggie Throop.
Thank you, Mrs. Social care provided by Labour-led Derbyshire County Council is failing miserably, with serious errors in process leading to, quite frankly, shameful consequences for some of my most vulnerable constituents. This is clearly not about funding, as they sit on reserves of about £233 million. Will my right honourable friend instigate an urgent review of social care practice at the County Council, because the people of Derbyshire deserve better?
Prime Minister!
My honourable friend has made an important point in relation to this issue, which is that the success of social care is not wholly about funding. It is about, actually, the practice on the ground. And that is why we are very clear that it is important to see that integration between social and health care at a local level, and local authorities should be playing their part in delivering that, and this is an issue that we need to see addressed for the longer term as well. Frankly, it's been ducked by governments for too long in this country, and that's why this government is determined to bring forward a sustainable programme for social care in the future.
Fari, what do you make of that?
Absolutely shocking. I mean, I can't believe Theresa May is so out of touch with how things are operating within social care. The pressures are absolutely extreme, and it is about resource, it is about funding cuts. And that bizarre comment around use of reserves, I mean, councils are already using reserves to plug these funding gaps, are already increasing through the social care levy, council tax. I mean, we are absolutely up against it. And this is having an ongoing impact on NHS, A&E rooms and other impacts as well.
And what about people that say, well, actually, people should sell their property in order to pay for social care for themselves?
So to add to the housing crisis even further, I mean, it's incredibly naive. I mean, when we talk about property, I think the only thing I would like to consider within that is perhaps a mansion tax.
Well, I believe, Clary would correct me if I'm wrong, but in Scotland you don't have to sell your property, do you?
No.
Because of course, you then argue that the Barnett formula benefits Scotland, but then a lot of the oil wealth didn't get spent in Scotland either. So there's all these arguments about who gets what and how. But it's also a matter of basic attitude.
Well, is it simple that actually what's happening is it's an end to the nanny state?
Oh, well, that's yes, it's an ideological goal. I'd also suggest that, in actual fact, if you wanted joined-up stuff, maybe the NHS should have been responsible for social care instead of dumping it on the local authorities, because then they know you've got one budget, you know what's going on, and it's not dependent upon whether any local council is managing or not managing to do it. Why create more problems? If it's a social care issue, which is a health issue, perhaps it should all be funded centrally by the NHS instead of having local authorities blundering around trying to sort it out.
Okay, well, let's look at some international stuff a little bit more now, because Theresa May is sitting on bended knee at the White House. At this very moment, before her great emperor, Donald Trump, this new kid on the block. We'll start with just a good little question at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, which relates to all of this, and that is Angus Robertson from the SNP talking about the possibility that food safety standards will plummet, and also that the NHS may be privatised to the United States as part of this deal that she's apparently doing with Trump right this minute.
Angus Robertson!
The European Union, which we're still part of, has amongst the highest food safety standards anywhere in the world, and we are proud on our continent to have public national health systems. The United States, on the other hand, is keen to have health systems which are fully open to private competition. They want to export genetically modified organisms, beef raised with growth hormones, and chicken meat washed with chlorinated water. Will the Prime Minister tell President Trump that she is not prepared to lower our food and safety standards or to open health systems for privatisation? Or does she believe that this is a price worth paying for a UK-US trade deal?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
We will be looking for a UK-US trade deal that improves trade between our two countries, that will bring prosperity and growth to this country, that will ensure that we can bring jobs to this country as well. And I can assure the Right Honourable Gentleman that in doing that, we will put UK interests and UK values first.
Well, it depends what those UK interests and UK values are. Does it mean UK interests are UK companies making bigger profits by cutting set standards or what? I mean, this whole thing of washing chicken in chlorinated water, I just find absolutely hideous. And that's fine, and then you can just sell it to people with chlorinated water all over it.
I mean, it's quite funny, isn't it? Because in America, you can't buy a Kinder Egg because of the dangers of having the plastic within the Kinder Egg, and yet you can purchase meat. And this goes back to as well the animal welfare related to it as well, meat that's chlorinated. It's bizarre.
Martin, it does look as if there may be an attempt to sort of bring British standards down from the European standards down to US standards. Mm. That seems to be what Theresa May's up to.
Well, what I find interesting about this whole thing is those that wanted Brexit were on the basis that we lost sovereignty to Brussels and that decisions were being made outside the United Kingdom and that we needed to bring them closer to home. Meanwhile, as soon as we get Brexit, we're rushing to the United States saying, give us a trade deal on any terms whatsoever, and that'll be, and of course this trade deal will be all cooked up behind closed doors, and they're talking about rushing it through in 90 days. Mm. And that means that British industry, and you know, Trump's made his position absolutely clear, America first, America first, America first, and we're going to sign up a trade deal with that in 90 days, which is going to be in our interests. Why would it be in our interest to sign any such deal?
One of the biggest bunches of our taxpayers' money that goes over to America, of course, is for the Trident nuclear submarine force. And we heard this week Downing Street covered up a serious Trident missile malfunction weeks before the crucial Commons vote. I noticed with amusement that day of that story that there was very little talk of the missile heading towards the United States, which was apparently what had happened, which I don't imagine the Americans are very happy with us. Firing, I don't know if the Royal Navy were having a bit of a laugh with them, but firing a fake nuclear warhead without actually a warhead in it, a missile, over towards the US. Martin, is this system actually reliable?
Well, obviously not. If that's just the case, then you know, it's been there for some time, and if it's still firing in the wrong direction, there's some questions to be asked, isn't there? And of course, the real issue is that they suppressed the information about it because they knew they had a vote coming up on it. I mean, the only case for us having Trident is it means that we could leave NATO, and if the Americans tried to threaten us, we'd say, we've got nuclear weapons, leave us alone. That's the only political use for it. But since it's actually an American system and they could switch it off at the flick of a switch, it's not even useful for that. And there is a question, why are we wasting money on this? And even if we're just talking military terms, what we've been doing in the last 10-15 years is fighting wars on the ground in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, wherever, and in actual fact that we haven't got enough boots and rifles because we're wasting money on Trident.
Apparently this missile was supposed to be fired 5,600 miles, crikey, that's a long way, to a sea target off the west coast of Africa, but it veered off towards America. Now actually this is the Independent article on it by Samuel Osborne, and he's saying that, well, the BBC didn't talk about that at all, did they?
And why are this we nuking West Africa? Can I just raise
well, it's a test, Martin, but the test went wrong and the missile headed off to America. I imagine that they then said, right, we better not let this one land on the White House, we better blow it up in midair or make it crash or something. But this is £40 billion that's being spent, Vari, on four new what they call successor class submarines.
It's crazy because it's not just about reliability but also relevancy. I mean, what I was surprised at is America surely has anti-ballistic missile systems, in which case they should have been able to detect the fact this nuclear warhead was off their shores. And I think that is one of the many reasons, many arguments against Trident, even as a defence technology, is that most countries do have anti-ballistic missile systems. And even if you were to shoot at America because they threatened us and we were out of NATO, it's very unlikely it would land anyway. So it's a very interesting discussion.
What about the actual efficacy of having a ballistic missile technology at all, Martin, in the big scheme of things? Obviously, the Russians have got these, the Chinese have got them, Americans have. Surely we need them too.
Well, no, I mean, does Switzerland need nuclear submarines?
Well, I'm talking about actually...
Why do we need them if Switzerland doesn't need them? We're a small country. Mm. Why do we need them? I can understand why the US has got them. I can understand why the Russians have got them. I can understand why the Chinese have got them. But why do we need them?
I think the Swiss just lend the money to build them, don't they?
Well, that's the whole point. The point is, we could actually make a step like the South Africans did many years ago and say, look, we don't need these. Mm. We're going to give them up. And that puts the pressure on everybody else to negotiate about it. Now, the real danger at the minute is the anti-ballistic missile systems in Romania and Poland, which are directly at the heart of the Russian state. Now, in theory, those missiles could knock out Moscow and there wouldn't be, because of the lead time involved, they wouldn't have time to press a return fire button.
I thought these were anti-missile missiles.
Ah, but these anti-missile missiles were banned under the ABM Treaty in 1972 because they're fundamentally offensive. They're not defensive at all. Mm. And the Russians are... You know, they've actually got these anti-missile missiles in Russia, in Romania and Poland, and they're there supposedly in case the North Koreans or the Iranians are going to attack Europe. They're not supposed to be directed at the Russians. The Russians know that they are directed at them, and they're pretty annoyed about it. But they're also quite rational. The Russians have got nuclear submarines. They will hit back if they are hit. But what's happening in nuclear planning in the US is they're now developing smaller and more flexible nuclear weapons, and they're talking in terms of fighting and winning a nuclear war. Exactly the sort of things they were talking about in the 1980s. In 1983, we had a Cuban missile crisis, which hardly anybody's heard about, where we were nearly all blown to pieces. CND, of which I was an active member at the time, we were right. We really were nearly blown to pieces.
Okay, well, staying on the subject of US and Britain, we had a blast from the past at Prime Minister's Questions today. On Wednesday.
Ed Miliband. Britain. It brings...
Right, honourable gentlemen, never knew he was quite that popular. Ed Miliband.
I was going to say, Mr Speaker, it brings back memories, actually. Can I say to the Prime Minister that as the first foreign leader to meet President Trump, she carries a huge responsibility on behalf not just of this country but the whole international community in the tone that she sets. Can I ask her to reassure us that she will say to the President that he must abide by and not withdraw from the Paris Climate Change Treaty? And in case it is helpful, can she offer the services of UK scientists to convince the President that climate change is not a hoax invented by the Chinese?
Prime Minister!
Well, I recognise the role that the Right Honourable Gentleman has played in looking at this issue of climate change, and I hope he recognises the commitment that this government has shown to this issue of climate change with the legislation that we've put through and the changes that we have brought about in terms of the energy sector and uses of different forms of energy. The Obama administration obviously signed up to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. We have now done that. I would hope that all parties would continue to ensure that that climate change agreement is put into practice.
Well, I was hoping he was going to mention torture there, since his brother Ed Miliband was foreign secretary when Britain was torturing David. People. David Miliband, yeah, and he's now sort of disappeared off from the country. But anyway, no, it was because torture, of course, is a massive, massive issue, and it's like Trump seems to be behind it. But anyway, what do you make of your former leader's reappearance at Prime Minister's Questions there?
I'm very glad, actually, that he raised the issues around climate change. Often they are put, particularly by this government, on the back burner, as it were. I think, given Donald Trump's recent, one of the first things he's done is shut down all the sort of communications around the science of climate change. It's incredibly worrying, and I think it's important that we raise this fact and raise the fact that actually the government at the moment is failing a lot of its objectives.
Well, I think not just climate change, but on a whole number of issues. Torture has been mentioned, but there are plenty of others. It's a real problem for the Tory party in this country because they tend to be allied with the US Republican Party. But the US Republican Party is lurching radically to the right, and the Tory party in this country seems to want to at least present a centrist image. But I'm afraid the Atlantic is a very cold, wet, stormy place. And you can drown there.
Oh, Martin, you're so dour. You're like that Angus Robertson guy from the SNP. Anyway, look, let's have a look at a little bit more locally. And this was really a bit of last week's news, but Vari, since you're here, investigation as Bristol Police taser a prominent member of their own race relations group from the past in the face. Now, I don't know that much about tasers. One thing I do know is you're never, ever, ever supposed to taser somebody in the face.
No. I think, I mean, the whole situation is pretty shocking. It was great that, in fact, that there was an individual there to be able to film that whole situation and how it played out. The fact that any individual can be stopped and treated in that way is horrific. Then that escalation to actually being tasered, and given, I mean, he was a prominent community member consulting on police relationships as was. I think it really shows that the police still have a lot of work they need to do with their beat officers, but also that they need to do a lot around the recruitment process to ensure that actually their beat officers also reflect the local community.
It's actually pretty scary stuff, Martin, wasn't it? I mean, actually, I suppose the big lesson here is don't hesitate. You see anything dodgy, whether by the police or anybody else, have a good... I mean, I'm not saying get your phone out and start filming, but certainly consider it, you know, and also get ready to do it. Mm. I mean, nowadays, we've all got the capability to reach a national audience, which, of course, this was covered all over the national press this week. Mm. Martin?
Six journalists have been arrested in the US for trying to cover the rioting at the Trump inauguration. They're all being charged under felony rioting. One of them's an RT journalist, but there's various others, for which they could get up to 10 years in prison, I think, and a £25,000 fine. And I think that is the way that things are going in the United States of America. Perhaps Theresa May needs to have a word about that with Donald.
What about this incident here, though?
Well, this is clearly absolutely unacceptable, and as it says here, the Avon and Somerset police have voluntarily referred the incident to the police complaints authority, as they should. I mean, nobody should be able to justify this. The officers concerned, I'm sure they will probably realise that they've made a big mistake here, and they've got caught. Because that's what sometimes happens.
Yeah, well, so well done to whoever it was to film that. Nice one. Fantastic piece of work. Anyway, the troubling trickle-down of phone-cracking technology. This is in the Bristol Cable. Great little... I did actually ask Alon Avirem if he'd like to be interviewed. He couldn't do it, but he's done this article in the Bristol Cable. Avon and Somerset's one of at least 28 UK police forces forensically examining mobile phones. We reveal powerful technology being targeted at low-level crime and the serious security breaches it enables in the hands of local officers. Over the past decade, Cellbrite, Cellbrite, an Israeli technology company, has become the go-to supplier for British police forces wanting to crack phones. In the past few years, mobile phone examination has been rolled out to local officers for investigating low-level crime on a mass scale. Mm. So I remember this incident last year, Martin, wasn't there, with Apple, and actually Apple refusing to allow the FBI to crack into their phones, and yet it seems that the Avon and Somerset Police, this is one of their favourite things. They want to take your phone, they want to get into it, they want to get all that info. And in fact, that can be a kind of phishing operation, can't it?
It can, although do you remember some years ago now, Tony, we had a Vox Pops done by Marina Morris, and she was asking about Edward Snowden's allegations that people's phones were being accessed and so on, and they asked a couple of lads down at the centre of Bristol, and it was a radio interview, obviously, so they can't see their photos, and they said, we only use a phone for 24 hours or so, and then we throw it in the dock.
That's called a burner, I think, isn't it?
And that's what you do if you want to avoid the police, and but of course, criminals know how to do that.
Look, the point here is this Israeli software. Mm. Is it right or wrong that police should be using this to crack through the passwords, etc., and get into your phone?
Well, in the US Constitution, written in the 1770s, it says that the state should not be able to interfere with private communications at all unless there is a reasonable suspicion of criminal behaviour. Mm. And that's written into the Constitution for a reason.
Look, I suppose the problem
here... Which is what Snowden's point has been all along.
Fari, I suppose the problem here is the police could arrest you, take your phone for one reason, and then go through everything, and then that's... Because it's basically like a window into your entire life.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that 1984 has recently topped the bestseller list. Very much, it strikes me, you know, Big Brother is watching you, thought crime, all this sort of preemptive investigation, and it's pretty terrifying. And I think against that backdrop of Edward Snowden, but against backdrop as well of Chelsea Manning and the fact that she was recently pardoned by Obama, it's very interesting that the police in the UK are now opting to move towards these measures.
Okay, but back again to the US. We've talked about it several times. I suppose it's because it's the big first week of Trump. The billionaire George Soros has ties to more than 50 partners of the Women's March on Washington. So in the pre-dawn darkness of today's presidential inauguration day, this is from last week, a choice as a lifelong liberal feminist who voted for Donald Trump for president, should she go on this march or not? And so what... What this article from Azra Namani was saying is that a lot of these groups are actually funded directly by George Soros. It's not just one group, that there are 50 of them, Martin. At least that's the allegation in this article. I mean, is this feasible that a march might actually be sort of backdoor funded by someone like Soros through these kind of astroturf groups that pretend to be grassroots groups?
Listen, George Soros is a very wealthy guy. I used to work in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, and he funded an awful lot of stuff. You know, and I remember putting applications in to his Open Society Foundation.
But there's a legitimate reason to march for women. I mean, what the sorts of things that Trump
and
has been saying.
Well, if they're allowed to march, they're also allowed to raise funds. You know, it shouldn't be a secret or a problem. Mm. But on the other hand, George Soros has been very much involved. He's noted in the West for his liberal politics. You know, he very much supported Clinton against Trump, but he also very much supported Clinton against Sanders. Yeah, he's got his agenda. And it's not just Soros that has an agenda. Sheldon Adelson, who funds the Republican Party, or the Koch brothers, they've got an agenda. And, you know, you've got people in this country who are big funders of politics and so on. They've all got an agenda.
Martin, I know for a fact that Soros has been behind some of these civil society movements in Europe, like, for example, in Ukraine.
Oh, yes, well, the colour revolutions and so on. He's very much suspected. I mean, in Hungary, for example, you've got a right-wing government in Hungary, which many of the people who were in it were funded by Soros back in the day when they were opposition. But now, of course, they're very unhappy because he's trying to unseat them.
And anyway, I want to get Fari to talk about this because you're an anti-Trump woman. What do you make of this?
I mean, it doesn't really surprise me, actually. I mean, I think just what's been said around the fact that a lot of these organisations need funding. They need to get funding from somewhere. And, you know, I mean, certainly in the UK, grants are drying up.
But it starts a bit like AstroTurf, doesn't it? Yeah. This whole term for a kind of fake grassroots movement, which is funded by some billionaire.
Something. I would argue that it's not quite fake because I think a lot of people attending that attended off their own volition. They weren't paid
That's
to
right.
And you had that fantastic march up in Canada, which I think was about five or six women who came out of their own volition. And in fact, you had marches here in Bristol as well. And this is constant. You always have rich people funding various organisations. I mean, example, Vivienne Westwood funded the Green Party at the last general election. So I think there's examples of this happening. And I think you shouldn't minimise the incentive and the motivation of the individuals involved with that march just because someone funded some of the organisation around it.
OK, for me, the most cynical thing to do with the Trump inauguration last Friday, focusing on that, I suppose, was the release of this Kinkora Boys Home report on the same day as the Trump inauguration. Sounds like a good day to bury bad news, Martin.
Well, the Kinkora Boys Home report, as we've covered in this show many times, the allegation was that the intelligence services were using boys at Kinkora as a blackmail of various figures in Northern Irish politics, particularly loyalist paramilitary politics. The report came out and was a whitewash, as far as I can see. They've said, yes, terrible things went on, but it wasn't the intelligence services. I think it's rubbish.
OK, Martin, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest Labour councillor for Eastville, Vari Threlfall. We'll be staying on just after the 6 o'clock news. After the Murdoch News, we'll be looking at self-building here in Bristol.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.
Live from the Sky News Centre.